Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. Today's topic is global political communication structures, the silenced and the other. I'm Anya, your host for today, along with my two other co-hosts.
Hi, my name is Polina.
And hi, my name is King.
And we are going to be analyzing how these well-established political communication structures create and direct the narrative of how people from different backgrounds are perceived. Now, first, I want to start by introducing this concept of a significant other that I learned by a well-known sociologist, which is Anna Triandafilo, who actually specializes in migration policies. Now, this term, significant other, refers to a nation, an ethnic group, or entity that plays a crucial role in shaping the identity of another nation. Now, its influence can be two kinds, positive and negative. In the case of positive, the significant other might serve as an inspiration to the other groups. Oh, and an example of this, to simplify the situation, is the European Union serving as a significant other for the Eastern European countries during the post-communist transition. Now, with the values of democratic governance, economic development, and social stability, the European Union was certainly an inspiration to nations like Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. But also, from the other hand, there is the negative side, which is viewing the significant other as a perceived threat. And some examples of these are groups of people who are framed as the enemy. Now, this I see to come as a result of discrimination based on cultural, religious, political, and economic backgrounds being different from the in-group. Now, because the in-groups in a nation share the same national identity and values, and anyone who doesn't fit into their box is seen as fundamentally different and labeled as a threat, but also often viewed as inferior to these in-groups. So the significant others in this case might be migrants, refugees, and religious or ethnic minorities. Now, as for the representation by the media, in traditional media, I would say there is a tendency that the dominant narrative is one that aligns with the agenda of the in-groups. So in cases where there is a populist leader, the traditional media might feed into those discriminatory practices and deepen the perception of a threat from these significant others. And on the other hand, social media, in this age of globalization, has reached a very large audience and generally removes the bias that traditional media in some cases has. And I see this to be a result of it being uncensored and having direct engagement and mobilization with anyone who is passionate with certain issues. And now I would like to invite Polina to further speak on the significant others, specifically in the form of refugees in Russia, and how they are perceived by traditional and social media.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I think it was a great introduction of the theoretical concepts that we are going to discuss further on the examples. And I think that this theory of the differentiation between an in-group and an out-group is very significant, obviously not only in the narrative construction or any public narrative, but also I think it plays a great role in the societal dynamics in general. And this definitely allows us to make a connection between how this theory is embedded, I dare say, in the human nature, and how the media narratives influenced by it and also in combination with it can influence the perception of different smaller societal groups in the society. And going back to the example with migrants and refugees, I'm going to be talking about Russia and the Russian narrative. looking at how migrants or migrant narratives are presented in state media, so in the media that is owned by the Russian government, and in some independent media. However, it is worth noting that most of the independent medias in Russia in the past couple of years since the full-scale invasion in Ukraine have been banned and pushed out of Russia. So now most of them are operating in Europe and are not directly connected to the Russian society, even though obviously still their primary target audience are people who live in Russia or Russian-speaking people. So in the state media, I was looking at a couple of major Russian information sources that are listed on the website of Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia. So they are definitely, let's say, state approved, and they represent the narrative of the Russian government. I think it is important here to divide migrants into two groups. So first we have people who, let's say, fall under the in-group definition. So those are primarily Europeans. That is, for example, some people from the post-Soviet countries who moved to Russia for certain reasons. That is also people from European countries, so that is Central European or Western European. Generally, people who are largely white and who are more similar to the to Europeans. And the second group, which would rather be an out group, are people who don't look like Europeans. So that is migrants from Central Asia, who are largely Muslim, or migrants or refugees from Middle Eastern countries like Syria or Afghanistan or others.
Yes. Backing off your point, Polina, I like your distinction between the in-group and the out-group. And I talk about that in the three key frames where you distinguish between the in-group and the out-group. And these are three key frames that are used to look at migrants. There's the moralization frame, there's the threat frame, and there's the rationalization frame. I would say that most times the moralization frame is the frame that's used to look at immigrants that are in the in-group, and it depicts the migrants as victims, you know, deserving of humanitarian aid. And for the out-group, most times the frame is normally in the threat frame, which portrays migrants as threats to national security, social order, and resources. I think that this is the 2015. I think that the 2015 migrant crisis in Europe is a great example of this playing out in action, whereby if we make a comparison between how people reacted to the 2015 migrant crisis and the migrant crisis from Ukraine, there are two very different reactions. And I personally think that this is a good show of how people react to the in-group versus the out-group, and how the media spins narratives that show the attitudes that the public have towards the in-groups and the out-groups.
I definitely agree. I think it supports my ideas very well, because I wanted to say that, yes, so to those, regarding those people who are regarded as members of the out-group, They're often portrayed in the state media with connections to jihad or to terrorism or different connections to terrorist groups. Also, migrants are often linked up with crimes if those crimes are considered to be dangerous to the state sovereignty. Then the migrants are, regardless of their or country of origin, are connected to the Ukrainian government or to terrorist groups also. And also a huge accent is made in the state media on the policies that limit migration or fight illegal migration, or policies that are focused on marginalization of migrants. So that is, for example, recently was reviewed a law that would prohibit migrant children who don't speak Russian to study in Russian schools. And it has been widely shown in the state media. And in the contrast, people who are considered to be members of the in-group are presented in a positive way. So, for example, there's a new about Germans, for some reason, migrating to Russia. And it is presented in a very positive manner that Germans are thinking of moving to Russia for the reason of economic stability and migration policies. So essentially, Germans are not regarded as migrants. Migrants are people who don't look European. And Germans are not migrants. They're just people who are thinking of moving into Russia, which is ironic in a way.
Yes, I also find it, that point interesting, actually, because it really ties into the two ways that people can view a migrant. And I would like to use it to key into how fake news exploited political communication frames. And I think that they do some things really well. And I think it, especially in creating the illusion of us versus the other, they have to do some like key things, which is obviously prey on emotions, because they are really rhetorics based in terms of the facts are more about how it looks than what it actually is. And another thing that helps to spreads the that helps propagate the feeling of us and the others is also just like how rapid things are spread through the internet now, because it's the internet age, and a lot of content that might be that might show prejudice can be easily spread, and people honestly get misinformation this way. I also find that refugee crisis of 2015 is a wonderful example of this, as compared to the Ukrainian crisis, whereas refugees coming into Europe, depending on where they came from, were either seen as a threat that's come to take their resources, or just people in need of humanitarian help. And I think this also points to deeper assumptions, like also how the threat frame dehumanizes migrants. And also this leads us to the point of the other. So because the threat frame usually uses fear to dehumanize the other.
I also wanted to bring up a comparison between the state-owned media and independent media, so going back to it, because I think it is important, because we have largely covered in class that in authoritarian countries, it is very difficult to find different narratives, or very difficult to draw a divide between the government rhetoric and media narratives, because obviously media is often directly linked to the government. But in independent media, so we do see some representation of migrants and their experience. So that is often interviews that are taken from migrants to ask them about their opinion, and also some legal and social support that is provided by some independent media outlets who the migrants. So it's not only a spread of information, but also it's financial and legal support. And also often independent media highlight the importance of labor migration for the economy. So rather than portraying migrants as a threat or as people who are gonna steal the jobs of locals, it is highlighted how important migrants are for such economic sectors like construction work or agriculture or the production sector and many others. And I think it is also important to highlight how in the state media, the narrative often, so as I mentioned, focuses on policies that limit migration or fight migration. Whereas in the independent media, we can actually see how the state rhetoric is different from the state actions. So actually, despite this whole rhetoric and presentation of migrants from Central Asia as a threat, we can see how the government makes it easier for labor migrants to enter the country, to stay in the country, to work there, because it essentially needs migrants for the economy. And also, I think we can see how the state definitely, despite portraying in public narrative migrants as a threat or as a very small and marginalized group, the government still understands how this group of people is largely growing and how it adapts to basically the new realities by introducing different, for example, social services in the migrant languages, which I think is actually, it's a very good initiative, I think. Yeah, but at the same time, we see how in the media rhetoric, it is mostly to atomize the society and keep the migrants in this marginalized position, to keep them away, to hide them, and take away their voice. They are not presented in the state narrative at all, or are presented only negatively in case if these migrants are not European. And in case if they are European, they're not considered migrants at all. And yeah, I think it is done because obviously influx of Muslim migrants from Central Asia is considered to be scary for the society, so it's portrayed as a threat. And also it is a threat for a wider and more important narrative of the Russian traditional values that the Russian government imposes, which largely relies on Orthodox Christianity.
Here I could also bring an example of the individuals or groups who are othered, and I would like to point out religious minorities. And I want to bring the example of France, which has implemented certain policies based on secularism, which is the belief of separating the state from the church. Now, these policies, although they might have had a good motive, such as to maintain religious neutrality in public institutions, they have had negatively affected religious practices, particularly the Muslim population. And because this policy is basically to ban the religious symbols in public institutions. Now, in most religions, this doesn't create a problem, but for Islam it does, because women who are practicants require wearing a headpiece, the hijab, and this policy basically hinders their ability to peacefully and safely practice their religion. Now, as for the media coverage, the traditional French media, who is state-owned, emphasizes the nation's commitment to secularism, portraying policies as essential to maintain national unity and secular values. And this just goes to show how much the local state-owned traditional media is influenced by the government's narrative. But if we look at international coverage of the international traditional media outlets, they have frequently highlighted the potential of discriminatory effects that these policies have had, particularly on the Muslim communities. And they have reported and discussed incidents where Muslim students have had been reprimanded, such as being sent home for wearing traditional attire like the abayas or hijab, which has raised a lot of questions about the potential discrimination and the stigmatization of the religious minorities. On the other hand, in social media, we have seen a lot of criticism and activism. In platforms like Twitter and Facebook, many users have expressed concerns that these policies have disproportionately affected Muslim communities. And there have been many discussions which often have highlighted the instances of discrimination and this stigmatization, which I previously mentioned, of the religious minorities, with some users sharing even personal experiences and advocating for policy changes.
Yeah, I think it's a very important topic. I think it was very interesting what you said about the example with France and with the restrictions on the wearing the hijab and how it is justified by secularism. But at the same time, I think there is a fine line that becomes more and more evident between this reliance on the value of secularism and pure Islamophobia, to be honest.
Yeah, I really appreciate your points as well, Anya. But something that really caught my ear was Polina's talk about how the government oftentimes does different from what they say they're doing. Like, actually supporting migrants and helping them transition, but they act a lot more hostile than they actually are. And I find this interesting because it leads us to think of what is the reason for this behavior. And yeah, a few things we can think about, like maybe a popular vote or just following the perceived wish of the people. But I think that's pretty puzzling. But another thing I would like to talk about is the impact on public perception and policy, and how this distinction between us and the other affects the public perception of people, which I honestly think is the main reason that there's a lot of harsh talk about immigrants. Is mostly about public perception, and is not grounded in reality. But in terms of how I think fake news affects this, I think it amplifies prejudices, and it basically makes us think about these things more. And it might also amplify these prejudices by just simply showing us more negative acts committed by immigrants than people that are locals to the society in question. And these are like indirect ways to amplify prejudices. It's not explicitly saying that these people are committing more violent acts, but it is implicitly saying it by showing you more content of that nature from that set of people. And it leads to, of course, with the amplified prejudice, it leads to increased hostility towards the other that's been created in this political discourse. And with that, it's not like, okay, that's where it stops at. It only increases hostility and prejudices, but all of this have an impact in the long run politically, because this public discourse and public opinion also fuels political action. So sometimes it leads to the legitimization of basically racist policies.
Polina, maybe you can mention about something about the LGBTQ communities.
Yeah.
In Russia.
Yeah, sure. I think, yeah, so another minority group that is often persecuted is not only religious minority, but that is sexual minorities. And so the LGBTQ community in Russia is officially recognized as an extremist movement. So it is prohibited to mention it in any way without mentioning that it is an extremist movement. And regardless of that, it is still widely mentioned in the state media. So I was, preparing for the podcast, I was researching, but it is obviously only mentioned in the negative way to create this negative narrative. And I think the narrative can be divided into multiple streams. So that is one about LGBTQ within Russia and one about LGBTQ outside Russia. So within Russia, the focus in media is mostly on the Russian police raiding nightclubs or private parties as a means of combating LGBTQ propaganda. So all, like, most of the private parties and nightclubs are blamed for LGBTQ propaganda. People are arrested for that. A reason for being affiliated with LGBTQ movement and so on, obviously portraying how the Russian government and the Russian police are actively working to eliminate LGBTQ people in the country. And the second direction that I mentioned are the connection of LGBTQ community and the presence of LGBTQ community in other countries. So when writing about the collective West, LGBTQ communities are also portrayed negatively in two ways. One way is that LGBTQ freedom, which is associated with spread of pedophiles or some other mental diseases, generally the freedom of LGBTQ community is portrayed as a mental disease. Also, another stream about Germany, for some reason, is that they took a statement by some German official in which they say that LGBTQ people may feel unsafe in some areas of Berlin, and then the narrative, the Russian narrative, was that before dictating their ideology or something to other countries, Germans should first, deal with their own country, which was a little bit strange to me. But also, another very important thing that I noticed in the narrative is the connection of LGBTQ community to protests in countries where Russia considers the regimes to be Russian-friendly. So that is currently, due to the protests in Georgia, it is a lot of news. So I just searched for LGBTQ, and a lot of news were about Georgia and Georgian protests, because I'm assuming that people who are protesting are believed to be members of the LGBTQ community, that the collective West tries to make Georgians submit to the LGBTQ propaganda and so on. So all these kinds of narratives. I think what is interesting here is that the LGBTQ community is not given any voice at all. So those people are not just not represented, they're wiped out of the society. So it is a certain collective body of people, a movement is called, but there is the members of the movement are not presented at all. They're not individuals. They're all just belonging to a certain movement which doesn't have any particular values or beliefs, because obviously LGBTQ cannot be considered really a movement. And obviously any appearance of LGBTQ community is an act of extremism. So, I think it's interesting how these people are not just marginalized or not represented. They don't have any individuality to them. They're just a collective body.
Yeah, I think it's interesting your point that the LGBTQ, like in some areas, don't really have their own voices. And basically what this means is that they're just used as a pawn for certain political agendas. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, I agree that the people belonging to the LGBTQ community are not regarded as people or individuals or anything. They're just the LGBTQ movement is used as a scapegoat, basically, for the other narratives that the Russian government is aiming to push onto the society.
Yeah, I like how you tie this in with the concept of the other, which basically, I think, works really well with migration as well, because sometimes the other doesn't have a voice, maybe legally speaking, or in this case, politically speaking, to even control your own destiny, and you're just being used as a pawn in a political scheme. So I really like that point.
So to wrap up, the global communication structure is far from neutral, but it just reflects and reinforces the power dynamics, as we saw from the traditional state-owned media and the comparison we draw with private media, but also with the social media platforms, which are a way of people expressing themselves uncensored.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, it's very important that in the modern world, obviously the narratives are formed not only by the, let's say, official media like TV or printed press or anything, but also by the people themselves on the internet, on the social media. And probably. So since we largely focused here on Europe and Russia, maybe we have some listeners from other countries. Maybe our conversation here would make them think about the political narratives and the representation of marginalized groups in their own countries, maybe in other regions, not necessarily what we discussed here. So, yeah, I think it is important to just stay self-aware and kind of, when you're reading the news, see not only what you're reading, but also remember what you're not reading. So essentially, remember about the groups that may be not represented or silenced or not given a voice, and also just keep that in mind.
Yeah, I agree with that. It is basically, from this, I learned that, when reading the news, on Polina's point, you should not look at things at face value and be more critical about what you're reading and try and see some things that might be behind it, like what might the intentions be of the certain news, or how does the news make you feel? Is that by design? Is that by intention? And in general, we should be more critical about the news we read and the information we take in, and think about what discourse this news is meant to propagate in the wider political sphere.
We thank you for listening to our podcast, and stay tuned for the next one.